Welcome once again, folks, to allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
What's new, Oren?
Well,
it's been a whole week since we've done this.
An entire week.
A lot can happen in a week.
It can. I've been listening to a lot of radio shows at work, and some of them have been really awesome. Like, I got to listen to Three Skeleton Key, which is like a really classic horror radio show about some guys in the lighthouse and a bunch of rats. Oh, and it's really scary.
How horrifying.
I know,
the rats.
Right?
Oh my gosh, the rats.
There'll be rats. No, it's really good. I recommend anyone who can should listen to it. And some pretty good Sherlock Holmes audio drama. Unfortunately, the podcast that I am listening to, which has like 5 years of archives, so it's taken a while. I'm working my way up, and I'm in their summer of 2007 right now.
Hooray.
and during the summer of 2007, they decided to do a very heavy fan fiction month where they were going to do specifically audio, either adaptations of existing works or just straight up audio fan fiction. One of the ones I listened to was this X-Men comic that they had turned into an audio drama. I don't think it was an original fan fiction story. I think it was taking a comic that already exists and turning it into an audio show. And it was so bad. Oh my god. It was one of the only podcasts I have ever not been able to finish. I got like 2/3 of the way through and I was just like, I can't handle this anymore. Because it was like everything you're not supposed to do in audio drama, where like there were long monologues that the characters were having. Sometimes they were internal, but sometimes the characters would literally just stop in the middle of an action sequence and have this long monologue. And you know it's an external monologue because then another character will respond to it. And then,
well, that sounds like a comic book style to me.
It is, but it doesn't work for audio. because in comics, that whole thing would take place in one text bubble. But in audio, it takes like a minute and a half, which is an incredibly long period for an audio drama. Especially during a fight sequence. And the characters will sometimes describe what they're doing in this fight sequence. And that's just, like, one of the basic lessons of how to do audio drama is don't do that. Because it's really boring. And
See Tales from the DMZ.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to hold up Tales from the DMZ as a masterwork of audio drama by any means. But,
well, I mean, from what you've described so far, we're definitely ahead of that.
We are. Because I realize that people don't want to listen to Andar's describing how he punched a Cardassian for, like, 5 minutes straight.
I would love to hear describe how he punched...
I mean, basically, if you can't describe...
Maybe that's the thing we should do, is have a personal log for each of the characters.
Maybe.
Andar's can, in fact, describe how he punched the Cardassian for 5 minutes.
I guess, but that's what I've been up to. Sadly, I'm not up to a whole lot of Star Trek-related stuff recently.
Shame.
I know, right? I keep thinking maybe I'm going to try Star Trek Online now that it's free to play, but everything I hear about it makes me think I don't want to. Because, like...
Well, what in particular makes you not want to try it?
Well, it sounds like they're going with the full-on sell power route for free-to-play. A lot of free-to-play games will do this, and I've noticed that the standard way is that if you go free-to-play, you can, in theory, get everything just by playing the game. But if you are willing to spend some money, you just get better stuff. And I have to say, that's one of the reasons I really respect League of Legends, is that League of Legends doesn't do that, except in the most roundabout way possible.
I think it really depends on what play experience you want. I mean, yes, that sort of model is existed in Star Trek Online. Like, without a doubt, it's there. But there is nothing stopping you, as you're saying, from being able to complete the content with all the stuff that you have available with you. Like, I've seen people who go in with, you know, the stock ships that you get for free into the STS, which is the endgame content, with not, you know, necessarily the best equipment, and they can still do the mission.
Yeah. I guess it's not really a big deal unless you're going to be PvPing.
In PvP, it makes much more difference, it's true.
Yeah.
Which, hopefully, they're going to get that worked on here. I mean, Perfect World Entertainment said that they want PvP to be a thing in Star Trek Online, and it kind of isn't really a thing right now. I mean, you have an organized PvP channel, but that doesn't make it accessible necessarily for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, like, it being accessible to everybody, what I mean by that is that I can, in fact, drop in the queue, get into a fight straight away. You know, what I really want them to do is put in that territorial control game that they've been, you know, mentioning here and there for the past year or so, where it's going to be, I don't know if it's going to be Klingons versus the Federation. I'm not sure what they're going to do for that exactly, but I really, really want that to be a thing.
And just, like, the general feeling I get from listening to interviews with Cryptic people and then reading, like, problems people have been having with the game on the forums, it really seems like Star Trek Online is a game with a team that's too small for it. Like, they made this game, but Cryptic is just too small a company to address all the problems the game has.
A lot of this stems from, and it's going to be kind of sound like a bit of a broken record for anyone else listening that has, in fact, read up on what's going on with Star Trek Online and Cryptic and Atari and way back in the day, is that Atari didn't know how to manage an MMO at all. As a result, there wasn't enough funds being shoved into Cryptic for Star Trek Online. You had, you know, staff shortages. At one time, there was a claim made by, I think it was Dan Stahl, who was the executive producer at the time, is that they didn't have enough coffee mugs in the office.
Apparently, he's coming back.
Well, he is back now.
Oh, okay.
Which, in of itself, is an interesting story. I'm not sure why the sudden turnaround and whatnot, but he left Star Trek Online Cryptic to go to Zynga.
The guys who make Farmville?
Yes.
What was he doing over there?
I don't know what he was doing over there. I honestly didn't look that too far into that part of it. But then, not even, I think, a month and a half, 2 months later, he was back in the Cryptic team, and he was part of the Foundry department.
Huh.
Yeah, like, he was in charge of the Foundry for a while, and now he's back in charge of the executive producer position for Star Trek Online.
Bouncing up and down like a yo-yo on that career.
Something, I don't know. I have my own kind of theory about that, and that's this. That Dan Stahl had, well, one of two things. Either he lied to us about all the things he wanted to do and the direction that Star Trek Online was going to go, or he wanted the Star Trek Online to go in a particular direction, but the Perfect World acquiring of Cryptic then stalled those plans out. And to either save face for himself, or Cryptic decided to do this so that they could shift blame around a little bit, they decided to have him, or he decided to go ahead and go to Zynga, is what it was, or at least leave Cryptic for a short period of time, while all these changes then were announced by Stephen D'Angelo, who was then the emergency executive producer hologram, as it's been dubbed by the forum community, or the EEPH, or whatever you want to call it.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah, we all got a kind of good laugh out of that. And then all these other things started happening with Perfect World Entertainment shaping into the game we have now. And then they did a switcheroo again with Dan coming back.
Huh.
I think that's probably the most likely scenario that happened. Because, I mean, you listen to Dan talk on a lot of other podcasts and whatnot, and I think that he has the best intentions for the game, but there was either a miscommunication between what was happening on the business end of it to the execution part of it.
Yeah, well, he definitely sounds like he has a lot of really cool ideas that just haven't panned out.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely, I think, is a motivating individual. And there has certainly been a lot of claims of overpromise, underdeliver. You know, that's the thing that has definitely been spat around for Star Trek Online. And understandably, I can understand where a lot of that hate comes from. Because we've gone on, we went for almost an entire year with no real good content update.
Yeah.
And we had things like the Duty Officer system that came out, which was really cool to fit around with for probably the first week. Mm-hmm. You know, but after that, it was kind of like, you know, this is it. This is the Duty Officer system. There's no real additional development you get out of it as you would in a traditional, like, RPG sense. I mean, really, it's kind of more like a collectible card trading game is what the Duty Officer system is. You know, we actually got a first taste of actual content with the 2800, which is the start of the Dominion War arc that I'm sure I was telling you about.
Yeah, I've heard about that. That sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, but, I mean, that was kind of a bit of a letdown, I think, in my mind, because of the way the action doesn't rise and fall properly. You know, it didn't seem like a very well-executed episode to me. You know, it definitely felt like they had taken a story and then decided to cut it up into little bits as opposed to going, okay, this is going to be Act 1, this is Act 2, this is Act 3, this is Act 4, this is Act 5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, which I think you should take a Star Trek Online and play yourself, since you yourself are a writer.
I do not have time to play Star Trek Online. I just don't. If I don't have time to get the next episode of Tales from the DMZ up, even though everything has been recorded and it's just sitting on my hard drive waiting for sound edits, I do not have time to play Star Trek Online. That would be a little hypocritical of me. But anyway, so today our actual topic is special effects in Star Trek.
Woo, special effects. Phasers. Pew, pew.
Phasers.
Warp drive.
You know, shields, explosions, shape-shifting, the works.
Weird sounds.
Weird sounds. Yeah, sound effects are very an often overlooked special effect. You know, especially
that's right. I'm hip.
Especially your all-famous George Lucas scream, which I don't remember.
Wilhelm scream.
Is that what it's called?
Yep.
Okay, I don't remember where it's originally from. I don't think I've ever heard it in Star Trek, although I heard someone saying it was in the new movie, but I don't remember ever hearing it. Do you know anything about that?
About the Wilhelm scream being in the new movie?
Yeah, I heard that it was there somewhere. That, like, when one of the Romulans falls into the pit, that you can hear that scream.
Which pit are we talking about?
The pit of the Narada. You know, it's got that big pit.
Oh, that's right. That
we talked about before.
Yes,
some the people who built the set plot. Thought they were building a mine, and it was actually supposed to be a mining ship.
I don't recall that specifically, but I think it would be very strange for that to be in there, because the only connection that this film has with any of the George Lucas properties is that I think J.J. Abrams is a fan of Star Wars, and that's it.
Yeah, well, that's why I assumed
it was. Because ILM there. Wasn't doing the special effects in this movie, I don't think.
No.
Yeah,
I don't think so either. Although,
which in previous movies, like in First Contact, for instance, we see the Millennium Falcon in the fight with the Borg cube.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I've heard that, but I've never been able to find it.
Yeah. So I mean,
supposedly Battlestar Galactica is in the fight with the Reavers in Serenity, but I've never been able to see that either.
I mean, the whole Firefly universe tends to have a lot of very generic ship designs. If you look at the Battlestar, you know, line of ships, that's a pretty generic looking ship anyway.
Right.
I mean, there's already a ship in Star Trek Online, if you look in the Foundry, with the generic ships and whatnot, that one of them looks a lot like the Battlestar Galactica as well.
Really?
Yeah, so I mean,
so who would win in a fight, Bob? The USS Enterprise D or the Battlestar Galactica?
Who would win in a fight? Yeah, Battlestar Galactica or the Enterprise? Well, Battlestar, I mean, this is definitely going to be, I think, a fight of strategy. The Battlestar, or I guess the Colonial Defense, what are they called?
Colonial Defense Fleet?
Yeah, their strategy seems to be involving fighter screens, flak barriers, things like that, and not a whole lot of maneuvering of these ships beyond anything like the, I would assume, the frigate level.
Right,
which I don't think we actually ever see a frigate on screen in Battlestar Galactica. We always see the
Battlestar
class, and we see the fighters.
We know that they do mention that there are other sizes of ships.
Well, right,
that are not just Battlestars, but they were all destroyed in the initial attack by the Cylons.
Right. The fight itself, I think, would come down to who had the ability to maneuver best. And if we're talking just the Battlestar Galactica versus just the USS Enterprise, or we're going to go with the Galaxy class on this one.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to bring PC hero nonsense into it, which is a literal discussion I've had with other people. It's like, oh, but if Picard was in command, it's like, I don't care, it's a Galaxy-class starship, I'm just going to deal with that.
Yeah. We'll assume competent commanders
on both sides. So a Battlestar versus a Galaxy-class. I would probably give it to the Galaxy-class, since despite the fact that the Galaxy-class moves slow, it can still maneuver a lot better, I think, than a Battlestar. Because a Battlestar's plan is to literally sit there, provide flak fire support, so that the opposing fighters don't come in and start raping the shit out of the ship, while their fighters go off and start dealing with stuff. Yes. Now, the Battlestar does have its own batteries. I mean, we've seen it fire, you know, guns.
Yes, before. It does have them. And it has a couple of nukes.
Yeah, which those are all projectile-based weapons with there. They're not energy weapons of any sort. And shields are really good at deflecting kinetic damage, as we've seen. You know, we've seen ships that, you know, come into ram, like the Enterprise, for instance, and they just bounce right off the shields, for instance. Not saying that the shields don't sustain damage, but the Enterprise targeting computers and whatnot are much more flexible. There's not as much math involved with trying to deal with firing, like, the phasers on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
The Enterprise, I think, would probably either not even feel the sting of the fighters that come its way,
Would
just blow them straight up out of the sky.
Because Vipers aren't armed with any kind of anti-capital ship weapons. A Viper's only purpose is to shoot down other small fighters, and the Enterprise doesn't have any. So the Enterprise can just ignore the Vipers.
Yeah, so, and we even hear in the CIC of the Battlestar that, you know, they're plotting, like, firing solutions and stuff, right? Yeah. Whereas the only command that the captain has to give the tactical officer is open fire.
Yeah.
It leads me to believe that there's much more of, like, a Windows point-and-click interface on the Enterprise, whereas, like, the Battlestar is dealing with, you know, like, Linux.
Not
saying Linux is bad, but there's more going into using Linux on the client side of it, like, the personal user, than there is with Windows. With Windows, I just load it up, I can just do whatever I want to do. With Linux, you have to actually go in there and program it a little bit.
Yeah, well, the guy on the Enterprise is playing a video game with his targeting systems, whereas the guys over on the Battlestar Galactica are actually plotting firing solutions and, you know, doing stuff you actually have to do when you're firing large guns. But, okay, I can't believe we actually just spent, like, 10 minutes talking about who would win in a fight. All right. I was sort of thinking you were going to cut me off.
It would be a really cool special effects fight.
Yeah, it would.
Bring it back on top.
All right, so special effects. When you're looking at special effects, you have two big kinds of special effects. You have practical effects and visual effects. Now, practical effect is anything that is actually filmed. So, like, you know, like a blood pack going off. That's a practical effect. Because the blood is actually there, it is not added in later. or a gun that's loaded with a blank, so that when the actor pulls it, you can actually, there's actually the loud sound and a flash from
the
muzzle.
There's a report of the gun.
Yeah, that is a practical effect. A visual effect is anything that is added after filming.
Phaser beam.
Yeah, phasers, transporters, and the like. And now, that's pretty much all done now through CGI. But back in the day before CGI, they had a lot of other weird ways to do it. Like originally, the transporter, according to Wikipedia, was created by turning a slow motion camera upside down and photographing some backlit shiny grains of aluminum powder that were dropped between the camera and a black background.
Yep.
That was how they used to do it. So, but you know, nowadays, visual effects have gotten much more
common.
That
technique actually didn't change much from TOS to TNG, from what I understand.
No, it was basically the same thing.
Yeah.
But, like, now with the advent of computers...
I think they used tinsel or something in TNG.
Yeah. I always thought it looked kind of like a waterfall in TNG.
Well, that may have been the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe, but...
But with the advent of computers and CGI being much more easy to do now, visual effects are becoming much more common. And, in fact, we are now seeing entire movies that are shot in visual effect, where, like, they shoot the actors with motion capture... And then the entire thing is filled in later on a computer. You know, see Avatar for the best done example of that. And, you know, see, like, the Star Wars prequels for some, you know, poorly done examples of that.
Just actually came out in 3D again, didn't they? Or the first one did. The Phantom Menace, which Megan and I made a point of not seeing it.
That's good. You should not see it. It's pointless.
Despite the fact that every time I come home from work, there's a big billboard saying I should see it.
Well, there's the Safeway. The Safeway at my work put out a bunch of discount bins with the DVD, with some kind of pre-order for the DVD or something. And I was like, no, I'm not.
For the 3D DVD?
I guess. I think that's what it was.
God, that kills me, because that technology for 3D in the home is not widespread enough, I think, yet.
No, it's really not.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I don't even know what the 3D on here is supposed to accomplish, but... That's, again, not what we're talking about. We're talking about special effects.
The 3D is a special effect.
It is, but there is no Star Trek 3D. Is there? Has there ever been Star Trek in 3D? I can't think of one.
None that I've experienced myself.
Yeah, I'm going to say that there hasn't been. I have never heard of Star Trek in 3D.
I think the idea has been pitched, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure someone has, but I hate 3D, personally. Like, the only movie that I've ever seen that used 3D well...
Everybody at Paramount and CBS, don't do Star Trek 3D. You'll lose my money.
My money. The only 3D I've ever seen done well... really well was The Nightmare Before Christmas in 3D. And Coraline, I guess, had some decent 3D, but not great 3D. And I didn't actually see Avatar in
3D. There's only one instance I've seen of 3D working really, really well. Mm-hmm. And that was Jackass 3D.
I didn't actually see that. I'm kind of glad I didn't see that.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't endorse Jackass or anything that they do at all. But Megan's really a big fan of it. And we went and saw Jackass in the theater. In 3D.
You've done that now. You can't undo it.
I can't undo it. I'm sorry to say that I can't undo it. But anyway, they actually had really good use of 3D because they literally filmed everything they did in high-speed 3D. So when the dildo came flying at the screen, it actually kind of looked like it was flying at you.
Huh. Well, okay. Nothing more than, you know, nothing scarier than projectile dildos, I guess.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So what is a special effect for? So this is a question that I think a lot of movie makers now need to ask themselves, is what is a special effect for?
Michael Bay comes to mind.
Yeah. In theory, a special effect of any sort is to try to help tell a story, because that's what, you know, television and movies are visual mediums, and that's what they have over, say, radio, is that they have a visual means of interacting with the story. Or not interacting with, excuse me, but experiencing the story and telling the story, yeah. So that's what a special effect is supposed to be used for. It's supposed to be used to help tell the story. And some, like, Star Trek does this really well sometimes. Like, say, Wrath of Khan. In Wrath of Khan, they did the phaser shots incredibly well.
Still my favorite effect to this day.
Right. And the damage to the Enterprise was extremely well done. The whole thing just made you go, oh my god, the ship is getting shot.
Oh my god.
This is terrible. And then they've also done it very poorly. In sequences like Macrocosm in Voyager, when the flying virus, which looks so
giant
fake,
viruses,
it really looks terrible. It's like the Doctor is wrestling with one, and it's so obvious that Robert Picardo is just wrestling with the air, and some poor animator has like 15 minutes to try to slap a bug onto his hands in post production, and it's just like, I'm sorry, Robert, I'm sorry you had to do that. I'm on a first name basis with Robert Picardo, I guess. I don't know when that happened, but
we're sorry, Mr. Picardo. We don't claim any actual familiarity with you yourself or your persons.
Man, if Robert Picardo listened to this podcast, that'd be awesome.
Wouldn't it?
But anyway, so...
Mr. Picardo, we'd love to have you on.
We make a lot of assumptions now. Okay, so you got, like, some of your... So we already talked a little bit about the transporter effect and how, mm-hmm. like, I think in our first episode, we discussed how the transporter was originally a money-saving device.
Right, because we didn't have any money for a shuttle.
Right, or for landing the ship.
Or landing the ship.
But the transporter itself is a pretty cool effect, and it's fairly easy to do. I really like how the TNG transporter pad, the roof of the transporter pad, the ceiling,
TOS one.
Yeah, just the original pad of the TOS transporter. I thought that was kind of cool. And it's also kind of neat how you can track what era of Star Trek you're in by what kind of transporters they use. Like TOS has the little golden sparkle stuff. TNG and Deep Space Nine have that whole weird blue, like,
we'll call it
silvery
waterfall
effect going on.
Right.
Except when it's a Cardassian transporter, in which case it's the gold swirlies.
Yep.
And the movies have sort of a weird, like, blue lines. Like, the movie transporters...
You're talking about the motion picture series? Like, Wrath of Khan?
Yeah, Wrath of Khan. Star Trek 1 through 6.
Okay.
They have, like, a weird, like, vertical blue line effect.
From the middle out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Voyager has the three flower, like, the, you know, has not flowers, like, the three dots that come out from the center effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then Enterprise has the weirdest one, which is, like, an explosion of blue dots. Like, the thing materializes, like, in the center first, and then, like, builds out. And it's kind of a weird-looking effect. I was very strange after looking at all the others. Which I guess makes sense, since the Enterprise transporter is supposed to be, like, a prototype.
The most sped transporter.
Yeah, the one that, for some reason, they have Reed operating, even though they, in theory, should have a well-trained expert to operate this barely functional piece, like, you know, piece of technology.
Like Tucker?
Or, I guess. I don't know. This is Enterprise's big problem, is that they didn't have money to hire extras.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so there's also, like, another big special effect you have going on are the phasers.
And yes, phasers.
Phasers are, you got your solid state beams, which are, you know, the standard Starfleet ones, and then you got your weird little blasts that, I think those are called globules, where they fire these
globules.
Like, I think that's actually what they're called, like the little balls of energy that they shoot. And you know,
I thought that was something that was referred to for, like, laser weapons.
I don't know.
Because they shoot gas. Compressed gas.
Maybe. I just know that that's what they look like. And Klingon weapons usually do them. And Jem'Hadar weapons fire those, you know, those blue spheres instead of a solid beam. Personally, I'm a fan of the solid beam just because I think that it's way harder to tell that the laser beam is moving far too slowly if it's a solid state beam. Whereas if it's an individual sphere or projectile of some sort, you can see it travel across the screen and you're like, that thing is moving awful slow. I feel like I could step out of the way.
You
know, as Picard does in that one sequence, which is
a conspiracy, right?
Yeah. Which is a clear example of why, of one of the weaknesses of visual effects is that, you know, sometimes the visual effect hasn't really been very well planned out, so the actors and the director just have to do, you know, whatever they're going to do, not really knowing what the visual effect is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people with the visual effects are like, we have to figure out how to make this work somehow. And, you know, and that's when you get a Picard stepping out of the way of a phaser beam.
And being hunkered down for probably 3 seconds too long.
Yeah, for all the glory that is. And, of course, you know, you can also see that they... for some reason, they have different color beams throughout the series. Like, TOS beams were green. The movies, they
blue.
Had... Yeah. Hmm?
Blue.
What?
Blue.
No, in TOS, they were green.
Blue.
They were green.
Blue. I promise you. You post this on the internet and ask, what color are the TOS beams? Everyone will say blue.
I'm pretty sure they were originally green.
Blue.
Well, what about...
blue.
Remember that...
Your TV's color is so off, Warren.
But remember
they
that...
were blue.
Okay, fine. They were blue. And then in TNG, they were orange. Come on. Okay, they were at least orange, right? No one's going to disagree.
Orange-red.
Orange-red. And they, you know...
Sometimes they were kind of like a blue-red, too.
Were they?
Yeah, if you look at actually Best of Both Worlds, when they're in the Borg cube fighting in Part 1,
mm-hmm.
you actually see that you have the red-orange beam, and then mixed in there is also like hues of blue.
Huh. I guess Best of Both Worlds is actually one of the things I wanted to talk about, which in that it has some of the best special effects.
It has awesome special effects.
In Star Trek, both because they look really good and because they are used to support the story very well. And, like, especially, like, that whole like plasma discharge thing that the saucer section is doing.
The antimatter spread?
Yeah, is that what it is? Antimatter? Yep. Okay, yeah, the antimatter spread. That thing just looked cool. And like really looked like, because the whole point of the antimatter spread is to confuse the Borg sensors. And that's really what it looked like to me. Like, I feel like I could have guessed what they were doing without any dialogue, just from the visuals, mm-hmm. which is a triumph of movie making whenever you can do that, or television show making, as the case may be. And of course, you know, they didn't skimp out on the phaser shots, and they also had the saucer separation, which is something, an effect I'm going to talk about a little bit later, but it was used to a very cool effect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, and we already covered Wrath of Khan, which had some really nice special effects going on there.
I really
there.
Wish I had that phaser type in Star Trek Online.
What, the, oh, you mean the, because Wrath of Khan...
The best way I can describe it would be like a pulse phaser. Right. Not similar to what the Defiant has, mind you, which is also called a pulse phaser. But they're literally just, because they didn't have the strip phasers, they had the ball turret phasers had. Which I really wish my Excelsior model had in Star Trek Online, because the little phaser strips look really dumb on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Excelsior Star Trek Online, you know, you're familiar with how it's designed, right? They have all the ball turret banks on the saucer, and then on the underneath, and then on top in the rear section, right?
Mm-hmm.
So each of those ball turret sections has been replaced by a phaser strip, a tiny phaser strip.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
So on the saucer, instead of like two strips, like you see on most starships, you have like five on top, five small strips on top, and five small strips on the bottom.
That's kind of goofy.
It looks really goofy. And the other goofy thing is that with the Excelsior, you know how on the primary hull, so we're talking the engineering section.
Yeah.
Yeah, the torpedo tubes on the starboard and port side, right?
Uh-huh.
On the hull, not in the neck, mind you, where it leads up to the saucer section, but in the secondary or in the primary hull. Cryptic, for whatever reason, decided to put them in the neck.
Oh, the torpedoes?
Yes, the torpedo tubes. Even though on the model, there are bloody torpedo tubes right there on the model.
Can't, wait, so does your ship sprite, for lack of a better word, does it actually show the torpedo tubes on the primary hull, but then the torpedoes fire out of the neck?
Yes.
That's just goofy.
It is goofy. That it bugs me to no end.
That sounds more like a mistake than a
decision. It is a mistake, and I brought this up on the forums, but then I was just like slapped down. But like, no, they always fire out of the neck. I'm like, no, see, Star Trek VI, they don't fire out of the bloody neck. Well, I mean, there are certainly two, I can only describe them as, like, mooring ports, because they do have these really goofy-looking, like, two kind of prong things that do stick out of the neck, but they're not weapon ports.
Well, especially since if they actually put the torpedo ports on the or the torpedo tubes on the primary hull in the model that they're using for the game, it seems like regardless of where they fired out of in the show, they should be firing out of those tubes, because what else would those things be for?
Right.
That's goofy.
It kills me. I mean, little things like that are the things that, you know, mount up and ruin my Star Trek Online experience.
Oh, man, speaking of torpedoes, did you know that the classic photon torpedo sound is is actually the sound effect that they used for the War of the Worlds death rays?
Really?
Yeah, it's the same sound.
Intriguing.
I think it's the one from the original, like, 1938 broadcast. I'm pretty sure that's the same sound effect.
That's rad.
According to Memory Alpha, anyway.
That is rad.
And then, of course, if we're talking about Starship special effects, the other big one is the shields.
Yes.
And Star Trek made the decision to go with bubble shields instead of skin, like, you know, hull-hugging shields, I guess, is the other way to describe
Except
it.
Except in Nemesis.
Did they? Yeah.
Nemesis had skin-tight shields.
Really?
Yep.
Huh. Well, in and Star Trek VI. In Star Trek VI, for some reason, they showed us the hull-hugging shields, because they didn't... In Star Trek VI...
I know we saw a display in engineering
that showed the shields, yeah.
That showed the shields around the ship in... You kind of did the silhouette. It wasn't really skin-tight. It kind of had the silhouette of the ship, if you didn't add any of the space or anything like that. But I don't think we actually ever saw a shot of... No, wait, I'm wrong.
Yeah,
we saw the Excelsior get hit.
And the
torpedo distinctly looked like it made impact with the hull, is what it looked like, despite the fact the shields are up.
And the same thing with when the Bird of Prey hits the Enterprise a couple of times, and we see those too. Other than the one shot where they just distinctly say that
the Bird of Prey was cloaked.
Hmm?
The Bird of Prey was cloaked at the time.
Yes, it was.
No shield when you're cloaked.
No. I'm talking about when the Bird of Prey hits the Enterprise. The Bird of Prey shooting the Enterprise with torpedoes. You can see the torpedoes look like they impact the hull, even though the shields haven't been breached
yet. Oh, yeah,
you're right.
Although
there is that one really badass shot where the torpedo hits the bottom of the saucer section
and blows through
and then goes straight up through the saucer section. But they make a distinct note that at that point the shields have been breached.
The shields are collapsing.
So in Star Trek VI, they went with the hull-hugging shields.
Mm-hmm.
And in all the other Star Trek movies, like in Star Trek II and III, we had they very clearly set for pretty much all those fights, the shields were out on both sides. Like, you know, when Reliant attacks the Enterprise, Enterprise's shields are down. When Enterprise hits back, Reliant's shields are down. And then in Star Trek 3, they shoot the Bird of Prey just as it's decloaking, and right. then their shields won't go up.
Their shields won't go up because the Enterprise is really sped right now, so well, they get fixed.
Well, no, it's not even that. It's that they are trying to run the Enterprise with five people, and Scotty set up, like, an automation center that would let them do it. But, you know, running a ship that has a crew complement of 500 with five people isn't really going to work very well.
No, that's cool, bro.
No, sir. If you could run it with five people, it wouldn't be need for all this crew.
See the ultimate computer.
Yeah. But in the shows, they very clearly go for the, they usually go with the bubble shields.
Yep.
Although, you know,
that's an easier effect to accomplish than having a skin tight
shield. You know, now that I say that, I'm going to have to take that back. Because they do it a couple of times in TNG, but in the Dominion War, where? Deep Space Nine.
Where do they do it in TNG?
With the bubble shields?
No, with the skin tight shields.
No. In TNG is bubble shields.
Right.
But in Deep Space Nine, they do skin tight shields, like almost entirely. Because if you think of the big fleet engagements, can you think of a single time when you can ever remember seeing a weapon hit a shield? They always look like they're impacting the hull. Like, just straight up, even when the shields have not fallen. It's the same thing when Deep Space Nine is attacked. Both the Klingon and the Dominion ships look to be just hitting Deep Space Nine, even though its shields are still up. Which is even goofier, because Deep Space Nine actually makes a specific point that it uses bubble shields. Like, they specify a shield perimeter at one point, the idea being that you could get inside the shield perimeter. So, like, that always kind of bugged me. And I assume that the skin-tight shields are just an easier effect because you basically just don't have to have them. If your shields are skin-tight, you can just say the weapon hit the ship and then not show any damage and be like, oh, well, I guess it hit the shield.
In Paradise Lost.
Paradise Lost?
The Lakota versus the Defiant.
Right.
The Lakota has bubble shields.
You're right, it does. But the Defiant has skin-tight shields.
It does have skin-tight shields.
In that episode. I think that's the only instance of Deep Space Nine I can think of having bubble shields. I know that TNG has bubble shields, especially if the Enterprise gets attacked. They use that same stock footage of the Enterprise getting attacked by Bird of Prey a couple of times, and you can see the bubble shields there. You can also see them in like a couple of other instances. But personally, I prefer bubble shields. I just think it's more clear. I really don't like not knowing if the ship has actually been hit or if it just bounced off the shield.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see why they're harder to do.
Star Trek Online uses bubble shields.
Yes. Because bubble shields are, like, more or less canon, but they just didn't do them sometimes because they were hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
Which, speaking of which...
I'm not sure I have a preference either way, though, with them, necessarily. I mean, if I was designing a defense, I'd rather have my barrier of defense be further away. So I think I'd go with a bubble shield.
I mean, yeah, like, practicality-wise is one thing, but just talking from a dramatic perspective, from enjoying watching the show, I prefer bubble shields. Just because that way I know if a shot has hit the shields or not.
Mm-hmm.
But then from the other standpoint, I actually realized that I think I prefer shields that dampen damage instead of just stopping it. Because right now in Star Trek, it's usually the assumption is that, and in most sci-fi shows that have energy shields, the assumption is that if an attack hits the shields, it's completely stopped unless the shields collapse. But that's not always the case. Like, clearly in Star Trek VI, the ship was taking damage even when its shields were still up.
Right.
And so the idea there isn't that the shields don't stop the damage, they just, like, they give you they basically dampen it.
Right.
Like, some of the energy, like, the shields have, like, a threshold, and if the damage of the attack exceeds that threshold, then you will still take some damage. Sort of like, I hate to use this example, but damage reduction from D&D yeah. has that same thing, is that's basically what the shields are. And that makes a little bit more sense to me, because it's otherwise you get what
silly Enterprise going off and facing CRs that are above its level.
Yeah, well, otherwise...
CR being challenge rating for those that are RPG challenged.
Yeah. Well, otherwise you kind of get...
That's right, I said that.
You did say that. Otherwise you kind of get what happened in Nemesis, which was that you had these ships pounding away on each other's shields, but because the shields... Basically, you didn't have anything to worry about until the shields fell. And that's not really all that fun. It's like, oh look, a bunch of lights are flying back and forth. Which is why I personally think in Wrath of Khan they decided to go with fights where the shields were down. Because once the shields are down, everything is suddenly way scarier and way more real.
Yep.
Whereas if shields just stop all attacks, then until the shields drop, then it's basically like, well, there's nothing to be afraid of until the shields go down.
Right.
And, you know, when you're having a big space fight scene, there should be some tension and some action, which is sort of dampened by that. So I can, so like a lot of times they do that and go with these shields as a dampener rather than a blocker, but they never actually specifically say.
Yep.
All right, so that was shields. So speaking of speaking on that same track, I want to mention the Dominion Wars briefly, or maybe not briefly as the case may be. We did spend 10 minutes.
Dominion War is not a brief thing.
No, it's not. But the, for its special effects. So Star Trek used almost entirely models for all the way through TNG.
Right.
And they didn't do any kind of CGI stuff until Deep Space Nine. And it wasn't until Voyager that they went like all CGI, and DS9 did the same thing, I think, in season 6.
Sort of. There was kind of a bit of a schizophrenia period, I think, with DS9. Because I clearly remember some episodes where they were distinctly using CGI, and then you'd watch other episodes later on that were, you'd have to pin them down as models.
Yeah, well, the Deep Space Nine...
I mean, the episode where... I don't remember the name of the episode, but it's... Or wait, it's... not the Die is Cast. No, it's not that one. You have Worf and Garrett going through the wormhole, and they are looking for... And the signal that was sent by Nobbert Tane.
By Infernal's Light?
Yes. That's a two-parter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, by that two-parter. Where the Bashir on the station is a changeling, and he takes to go blow up the Bajoran sun so we wipe out the system, all that good stuff. Those action sequences with the Defiant and the Runabout were CGI.
Yes.
No doubt about it, because they look terrible. I thought those effects looked absolutely horrid. And then we get later on with things like... I think it's Sacrifice... Which one was the one where they retake DS9?
Sacrifice of Angels.
Sacrifice of Angels. A lot of those ships look like models to me.
Those are all CGI.
Those are all CGI? I don't think so. I mean, because you have like a stationary galaxy class, for instance, and it looks very much like a model to me, as well as the Defiant that flies by looks very much like a model.
Well, see, there's a difference here between CGI and good CGI. like, if your CGI is good enough, it is indistinguishable from a model. Now, that kind of CGI takes time and talent, and so it's not super common.
Okay, well, they did a very good job then cleaning it up between By Inferno's Light and then also to the Dominion War.
But as I understand it, the Defiant was almost always CGI. I don't think the Defiant was ever a model.
Hmm.
The station was always a model. Like, the station was a model right up until...
No, I'm pretty sure they would have had to have done the Defiant in model form of in some way before... Either as a case study or as an actual production thing. Because, I mean, early Defiant runs, they very much had it not doing the dips and dives and barrels that we see doing later on anyway.
Right.
Which those are hard effects to accomplish with a model.
Yes, they are.
Right. You can do them still, but they're just harder to do. So.
Right. Well, according to Memory Alpha, and again, this is all, or not even Memory Alpha, this is Wikipedia. According to Wikipedia, the Defiant was almost always a special effect. Or, excuse me, a CGI. And I think, and that may or may not be entirely true, but I know that the Dominion ships, and the Federation ships that were fighting them during the Dominion War were almost entirely CGI, just because models are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell sometimes. Like, there are some instances where you can see the ships flying forward, and it's like, oh, those are obviously CGI. And then there are sometimes, like when you said, when they're just really good-looking CGI, and they look like models.
Yep.
And then every once in a while, they will cut to some stock footage that is a model. Like, there's this one piece of stock footage that they absolutely love that is a Cardassian Galor ship getting hit with a couple of blasts. And they use that stock footage so often that, like, if I was going to make a DS9 drinking game, that would be one of the things that would be on it. Be like, when they use this stock footage, take a drink. And I'm pretty sure that's a model, because that's an older piece of stock footage.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not positive on that. But the Dominion War, one of the reasons that they were all CGI was that the Dominion War was actually done on a very low budget for what it was. And models are just very expensive, and CGI is relatively much cheaper, which is why Babylon 5 went with all CGI. And you can tell Babylon 5, especially in the beginning, is operating on a very low budget, because Babylon 5 CGI ships look like crap. Just straight up. Like, I almost stopped watching Babylon 5 because their exterior space shots looked so bad.
Uh-huh.
And then but Star Trek, because Star Trek was a much higher budgeted production, was able to get better CGI for the most part. And, you know, sometimes, and again, it gets to the point where sometimes you can't tell the difference. But models have a lot of obvious drawbacks in that it's hard to blow up a model because, you know, if you want it to look at all realistic, you actually have to blow up the model and then you have to make a new model, and that's expensive. And, you know, sometimes you drop the model, and then you have to have a special episode, and then you have to have a special line of dialogue explaining why the Romulans are using Klingon ships now. Sometimes that happens.
I was hoping we'd bring that up.
Yeah. So, like, even though I do prefer models, I understand why they stopped using them. But, like, you know, for example, there's that one explosion in, what's it called? Is it called Time Loop? Time and Again? It's the one where the Enterprise is stuck in the Mobius Loop in TNG. Do you remember what it's called? It's the one with the, they get out of it by sending the number 3 back in time.
Oh, you're talking about the Kelsey Grammer episode. That is Cause and Effect.
Cause and Effect, yeah. Like, that, there's an explosion where the Enterprise is destroyed at the end. And that is them actually blowing up an Enterprise model. And it looks so cool. And you can tell that it's a model because pieces of it fly off in, like, every other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just hard to get that effect with CGI. Like, you can do it, but it's much harder. And so I think that the Dominion War was a good point to use CGI, because if they had tried to stick with all models, it wouldn't have been nearly as big and epic as it was. But I really hope that the models haven't died out as a, you know, as a science fiction show thing, which I'm kind of afraid they have.
I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. I mean, I really like models, and I want them to use them more.
The new movie didn't use any models, did it? It was all CGI as well.
No, the new movie is all CGI. And the new movie was one of the things I wanted to talk about in an instance where I feel, and this is more from a storytelling perspective than a technical standpoint, but the special effects in the new movie were pretty good. Just straight up, they looked good. Sometimes I disagreed with the tone they went. I wasn't crazy about neither of us is crazy about the Apple Store
command center.
Yeah, but I really feel like there is so much time devoted to the special effects in the new movie that a lot of the storytelling gets lost. Not as bad as it was in Nemesis. In Nemesis, they just spent all of their time on the special effects, and you have that incredibly long, drawn-out Nebula space fight that takes forever.
How long is that sequence?
The sequence is really long. I haven't timed it
but we should find out.
I should. Maybe it's not as long as I remember it being, but it just feels really long. Because you have these ships firing at each other, and, like, unlike Wrath of Khan, where each phaser shot was, like, a big thing, this feels like they're just sort of spitting at each other back and forth. You know, and not really accomplishing anything. Even though it looks nice, it's like, well, what's... You know, I'm kind of bored now. Like, okay, can we fast forward to the part where one of their shots actually does something? That would be kind of cool. And okay, so where was I? We're just talking about special.
We got sidetracked by Apple Store Nemesis.
Yeah, we did a bit. But I wanted to talk about one of the things that Star Trek the show has done a couple of times, which is they have occasionally introduced a special effect that they then realized was too expensive.
And do elaborate.
Okay, well, there are three potential times I can remember this happening. The first was the saucer separation in TNG. Because, you know, fans of the show will know that the saucer section has separated a total of 3 times on screen. Once in the first episode, once in Best of Both Worlds, and once in the movie Generations. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And there were
I would discount the movies. The movie had a much higher budget than the show did.
Right. So, I mean, you could say it even only happened twice in the show.
Right.
Even though there are many instances where it would have made a lot of sense to separate the saucer section. Like, for example, in the last episode, when they were flying the ship into the horrible, like...
Anomaly? You know, time anomaly?
Yeah, time-space asshole. because they didn't need the saucer section for that. All they needed was the warp core to make the static warp shell thing. And it would have made a lot of sense to evacuate all the non-essential personnel into the saucer section before they did that. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other instances where that's the case. But they can't afford it. The saucer section separation is both very expensive and it takes too long. Like, that whole sequence is fairly long, and they don't do it very often just because of how much it breaks up the flow of the episode.
Right.
So that's one example. That one's not too bad because it takes so long, very often you can justify it by saying they don't have the time to separate the ship every time there's a problem. And apparently...
I have a question. Did they perhaps just reuse the footage from the first episode for Best of Both Worlds?
I don't remember, honestly. Because,
I mean, the one particular shot that I recall, which is a kind of underneath shot and forward of the main deflector, I'm pretty sure was used in Encounter Farpoint.
Probably.
I mean, the difference being is that in Encounter Farpoint, they're at warp. In Best of Both Worlds, they were just sitting still.
I mean, that's probably the case. I couldn't tell you for sure, but I would not be surprised. Especially since, like, it basically just does the same thing. It's not like they're transforming. It's not like they're separating under, like, some kind of extreme
Enterprise, Decepticon, or Autobot.
Oh, my God. Let's not get into that. But they're not separating under any kind of super, like, difficult circumstances, so it could very easily be reused footage. Mm-hmm. And it would, you know, have saved money on a show that was already very expensive.
Right.
All right, so there was that. Then the next one was Odo. I think I've mentioned this before. I don't remember where exactly, but I'm pretty sure I mentioned before that Odo's shape-shifting was something that is really cool when they do it. It looks neat, and I really like it. But it's just very expensive.
It is very expensive, I imagine.
And they don't do it very often. And they do it a lot more later in the show when they had a bigger budget. And that much is pretty clear. But there are a number of instances, especially early in the show, where Odo really should have used his shape-shifting abilities, but he doesn't because they can't afford it. Like, there are any number of fist fight sequences that Odo could have just ended by, like, throwing out his arms as tentacles and grabbing the participants or what have you. But, you know, just, he doesn't do that. In fact, very often he'll just sort of stand there with his arms crossed. Sometimes he doesn't even participate in the fight, and I'd like to think that's because they were still figuring out the makeup on Odo and that he probably didn't want to, you know, mix it up and risk some of his prosthetics falling off.
Uh-huh.
I know that that's definitely a problem they had with the Ferengi when the Ferengi are having their fights. Like, if you watch really closely when Rom and Quark are wrestling around on the ground, you can notice that they are both being very careful not to damage each other's prosthetics. And it's like, you know, it's not obvious. You have to be looking for it to see it, but it is there. And that may have been part of the reason, too. And that's just another thing where it's like, you know, this is a problem with shape-shifting and with putting in an effect, something that one of the main characters is supposed to be able to do, but for some reason the constraints of the show stop you from doing it. It sort of makes that character feel a little weird.
Uh-huh.
In much the same way that they had Troy with these psychic powers that they then realized she couldn't use because it would destroy a lot of drama.
Right.
And so they're just like, oh, okay. I guess she doesn't ever give anything useful. And the last one that I can recall, and I'm sure there have been others, but this is the other one that I've recalled, is Voyager with their landing the ship. Because again, that is a very special, that is a very expensive special effect. And they only ever do it, like, I think twice? I can only remember them doing it twice. Once was in...
When the Kazon take over the ship.
Did they actually land the ship for that?
Well, they kicked all the Voyager crew off.
Right, but did they actually land it?
Yeah.
Because there was
a shot of the Voyager crew staying there and watching the ship take off.
Okay.
Why they had to land the ship, I don't know, but...
Okay, well, I take it back. They've done it more than once, I guess, more than twice. Because the only time I remember them doing it was in the first episode where they did it, which is in the 37s. Which, they landed the ship basically for no reason. Like, landing the ship didn't actually serve any purpose in the story.
Well, there was one where they had to do some sort of maintenance on their warp nacelles or some sort of, because I can remember very distinctly a shot where one of the warp nacelles was dismantled.
Mm. So I guess they've done it a couple of times, more than I thought. There's the one with the, I don't remember the name of this episode, but you remember the aliens called the Vaudoir?
Vaguely.
They find these,
those are the dinosaur people, right?
No, those are later. They find these like weird subspace, like, you know, tubes basically that the Voyager falls into one of them. And then they find out that there's this alien.
Oh, yeah.
There's these aliens who invented them who, like, were all wiped out except for, like,
and they're one. Hiding under the planet's atmosphere, yeah, or something.
They were, except for, like, one battalion that's in stasis. And Voyager landing was actually very important to the plot of that episode because that put Voyager in a situation where it couldn't easily escape from these aliens who at first were their friends but then became a little bit more hostile.
Right.
And so that was actually very important plot-wise. But there are a number of episodes... Patrician comes to mind, where they have this whole hubbub about how they can't transport down and taking a shuttle down is dangerous. It's like, well, why don't you land the ship?
Land this whole big ship down there.
Sounds like a good idea. especially since that was one of your original justifications for landing the ship, is that you can't transport and trying to take a shuttle down would be too dangerous. And it's just sort of like, well...
This is a dangerous situation. Let's put the whole ship there.
Well, I mean, you know,
Which, when you think about that, that's actually... a worse command decision, I think.
Well, the idea being that, like, the wind conditions are too intense for a shuttlecraft, but, like, the whole ship is much larger and more powerful, I guess, is the idea. Personally, I don't understand...
I don't know, man. Voyager got kind of owned by a cyclone, remember?
Yeah, I do. That was in Tattoo, wasn't it?
I don't remember like what they the tried to was, land. But I remember there was a very big deal about like a typhoon like giving them a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I don't understand why a Voyager can even land at all. That just seems like a strange design element for a large spaceship. It seems like they were, again, it's like they were trying to make Voyager different somehow, by giving it this cool thing it could do, but they just didn't use it all that often. Just not a thing. Oh, and I completely forgot. No discussion of bad Star Trek special effects would be complete without mentioning the little pop rocks explosions that they have in Nor the Battle to the Strong, where when Jake is running through this field of, like,
mortar fire.
It's supposed to be Klingon mortar fire, and these little puffs of smoke are going off all around him, and I'm like, huh, that's what the Klingons are using to bombard you with? Those look like they might, I don't know, scuff your shoe a little bit if one landed on you.
A little bit. Just a little bit.
And that was like, never before has all of the tension been sucked out of a scene like so badly as that.
Yeah.
But the rest
of
the episode...
That's where they go to Vietnam, right?
Yeah, that's one of their... They actually have a couple of Vietnam episodes. That's one of their Vietnam episodes. And then the Siege of AR-559 is also kind of a Vietnam episode. 558. Ah, damn! Okay.
TOS phases are blue-orange.
Ah, they're blue.
What about the remastered episodes?
You know, I have seen some of the TOS remasters, and in general, I like them. I think in general, they're pretty good.
I don't think they're necessarily up to par with like today's CGI.
No, they clearly could have.
They are way better than what was available in the 60s, though.
No, and they clearly
way better.
They clearly could have done more if they had had more time and budget. But they did what they could, and we have a little bit. Like, some of the outside space scenes are a little more clear, like, especially in the Doomsday Machine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, that whole space battle, it's way easier to tell what's happening now with the digitally remastered stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I do sometimes, although this is something that came to mind, is that I realized that one of the restrictions of the... Because in TOS, they had a very, very, very restricted ability to do exterior shots, they did space battles much more like what we later saw in Battlestar Galactica, with their space battles to consist of a lot of like firing solutions and like talking back and forth between the bridge and the weapons crews, and then firing once and waiting for the effect. Mm-hmm. And much more like an actual like ship combat, as opposed to what we have later in Deep Space Nine. And I don't really think this is Star Trek's fault necessarily, this is just sci-fi as a whole and television. But we have in Deep Space Nine, we have these massive fleet battles that really look more like airplane fights than ship fights. Yeah. You have like the Defiant doing loop-de-loops, and even like larger Federation ships are maneuvering more like planes than ships. And personally, you know, I prefer more nautical type battles to what we ended up having.
Yeah,
so that's just a case where I think the limitations may have made it a little cooler. But so, and apparently there's also a remastered TNG stuff, which I have not seen any of.
There is. I saw commercials for it, and the only one I saw advertised at the time was the Encounter at Farpoint. And this is on the TV quite a while ago that I actually saw these, they're remastering them. And they're going to be releasing them on, like, Blu-ray, I think, is what they're going to do. I don't know about DVD, but I know Blu-ray is a thing that either has come out or it's going to come out.
But what is a Blu-ray?
What is a Blu-ray?
Blu-ray sounds like some kind of exotic sea creature.
Well, actually, Blu-ray is... I mean, have you ever looked at the back of a CD?
Yeah, I have.
You see how you get that rainbow effect on it?
Uh-huh.
So there's a certain spectrum of light that's on the back of a CD, and what we've finally done is unlocked the blue spectrum on CDs. So now we can actually store more information on a CD because we've got that blue on it.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
That's a very, very rough sketch of the science behind it. There's way more in-depth about it. That's kind of what I understand about it. But I haven't seen any of TNG remastered myself. I have seen, like, TOS remastered. What I want to see remastered for TNG are three very particular episodes.
Yeah.
Yesterday's Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to see that space fight done. And I'd love to see the Ambassador redone as well.
Yes, I would too.
I would like to see that. Darmok. Because phasers don't shoot out photon torpedo tubes.
Nah, well, in Darmok they do.
Let's fix that. Like, come on, guys. Let's fix that. And then Matter of Honor, which was in season 2, where Riker's on the Klingon Bird of Prey.
Right.
And there's one particular scene at the end where they're fixing the Klingon Bird of Prey, where the Bird of Prey is kind of cocked at a very weird angle, and this matter blue stream is coming from somewhere on the inside of the fin of the port nacelle of the Enterprise.
Huh.
Not the deflector, not the phaser ray, just coming from somewhere near underneath the port nacelle.
That's just some guy hanging out the window with a repair gun.
Like the TF2 medic.
Yeah, exactly.
The healing hose.
That's what that is.
I mean, those are three very glaring things I'd like to see fixed. As far as TNG goes, and if they're going to remaster like a whole bunch of them, we're only doing a few. Other things that are in TNG off top of my head that I think they did really well, like Best of Both Worlds. I love seeing that field of destroyed starships out there.
Yeah.
Could it use some touch-up? A little bit, I think. Just in the respect that I like to be able to identify more of the ships.
Yeah, it would be
that
nice.
That are out there.
Well, because like, if you look really closely, you notice that a lot of these hulks are ships that we have never seen and will never see ever
again. Well, a lot
again.
Of them were like case study ships that yeah. they use. Like the Excelsior case studies are out there, where they literally had a four-nacelled, like, flatbread-looking thing attached to four nacelles that they had out there, which is kind of similar to what like the Constellation class turned out to be.
Yeah, well, they were like, quick, guys, we need a debris field. Like, pull out every model you've got.
Yeah. But being able to, I guess you could say, put to rest a little bit a lot of the, not controversy, but the analysis of that field to see what starships were involved, what class they were, things like that.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of speculation about, like, other Starfleet ships that we don't see that I don't think was ever the intent of Wolf 359. I think they just, you know, they didn't have, like, 30 Excelsior models lying around to use as the debris field.
Yeah, and that's fine. But I would still also try to keep some of the similar design that they have in there right now. Maybe have an extended shot of the Enterprise flying through the debris field so you can have a little more closeness for those ships. Things of that nature are what I'd like to see out of remastered TNG.
I'd really like to see, much later down the line, I'd like to see a little bit, just a couple of touch-ups to Deep Space Nine, in that I want to see more ambassadors. And I know you say that if you look in the background, you can see an ambassador class, but I've never seen one. And if so...
You also think TOS phasers are green, or...
Yeah, apparently. But even if it is there, it's clearly so far in the background that it's very overshadowed by the Excelsior and the Miranda, both of which are significantly older than the Ambassador class and significantly less powerful.
It's not my fault that those ships are just that much cooler than the Ambassador, Orin. I'm sorry.
I also think the Ambassador
Keep in
looks
mind
cool.
that the Miranda is the starting ship for Star Trek Online, and you can get the Excelsior,
yes,
but
you
can't get the Ambassador.
No,
yet.
No one cares about the Ambassador.
No, people actually do care about the Ambassador.
Okay.
Why they haven't released it, I don't know. It might be a time thing, which I highly doubt, or they're probably looking for maybe the right time to produce it, which is silly, because the Excelsior didn't have an introduction thing. They just said, here's the Excelsior.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of other ships, they just kind of said, here they are. So I think that excuse is really lame. But anyway.
But personally, I want to see more Ambassador class ships.
More Ambassador.
And I'd like to
see
them.
Why just marry it if you love the Ambassador so much?
Because it's not legal in this state.
Oh, okay.
But,
we went to Cambodia. It's probably legal there.
I want to wrap this up by talking about, because we were talking about a whole lot of digital remastering stuff. They have to be careful not to do what they ended up doing in the last episode of Enterprise. Because if you notice, like, the NX-01 Enterprise, that's a CGI. They had never used a model for the NX-01. But it looks pretty good. Like, it looks like a ship.
It's the Akira upside down.
Yeah, basically.
You know that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I know what its design is. I'm just saying that, you know, from what it is, it looks like a spaceship. It doesn't look like a CGI thing.
Not made of wood, mind you.
Yeah, not made of wood. But in These Are the Voyages, when they show the occasional external shot of the Enterprise D, because anyone who hasn't seen it for a while, that's the plot of These Are the Voyages, is that Riker is watching the last episode of Enterprise on the holodeck.
That's coinciding with
Pegasus
from season 7.
But they show us the occasional exterior shot of the Enterprise D, and it looks so fake.
Yes, it does.
It looks like they spent about 10 minutes cobbling that shit together.
It looks
together.
Like it's out of a video game, literally.
It does. And it's just like, you know, that's just a really serious break in immersion when you go from this very realistic-looking spaceship on the NX-01 to suddenly the Enterprise D, which we've all seen before. We all know what the Enterprise D is supposed to look like. And it suddenly looks like this sort of special effects blob. And it's like, what the hell? And the only thing more jarring was the shots of 10 forward, because clearly they didn't have the original 10 forward sets anymore.
Uh-huh.
So they were using this set that they'd cobbled together to try to look like 10 forward. And just to hammer home how much it didn't look like 10 forward, they used some stock footage of actual 10 forward. And it was like, oh my god, these things do not look like the same.
No.
One of these is not like the other. But... Okay, so yeah, be careful. Anyone who is doing digitally remastered stuff, don't make it look like it's out of a crappy video game.
Yeah.
Because you might as well just leave it like it is, if that's what you're going to do.
Yep.
All right, so thank you all for listening. I think this is All Things Trek signing off. Thank you for listening to All Things Trek. This show is distributed under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which means please share it, but don't change it or sell it. Remember, resistance is futile.